NASDAQ down for the week. Rates continue to rise across the curve. Will the rotation from growth to value continue? We discuss these topics today with Ed Harrison and Jack Farley. It's been an eventful week. Let's run through what you guys are thinking. Ed, let's start off with you. What's on your mind?
Yeah, as you could probably imagine, I'm thinking about the bonds, credit markets leading. I think the way I'm looking at it is that credit is leading the market and all the other markets are following as a result of that. The most interesting thing for me is just going back 2 weeks to that Thursday when I was talking to Katie Stockton, who said that, tomorrow, the next day, we would have a price signal where two Friday consecutive Fridays above a 114.25 level, I think it was, that she gave us, would mean that we were breaking resistance at that level, and the next stop was 150. And interestingly enough, here we are just below the 150 mark. We actually shot above yesterday, and we're meeting resistance at 150. It was a really steep move in rates. I think that we were well extended, and so obviously you would expect a pullback, but according to the technicals, this is the area of resistance that we should expect. So we might be lingering here for a while. So potentially, if the rate move is over, perhaps next week will be a calmer week.
Yeah, so obviously the curve steepening on the 10, same thing happening on the 30, and also a little bit of some juice happening at the front end of the curve, the two-year yield. Jack, I know you've been watching the rate situation as well. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I think the magnitude of this move really can't be overstated, Ash, especially with regards to how quickly it happened. You know, I listened to Jim Bianco and Ed's interview on RVDB yesterday, and I was titling it, and I came up with the title, Stocks Follow Bonds Into the Slaughterhouse. And then I said, you know, that's a little bit too dramatic. Yeah, at Real Vision, we don't like to dramatize things. But then sometimes when the move is this big, you really have to give people a sense of just how colossal the move is. I mean, it's caused obviously a tremendous rotation from growth into value, with your high flying tech stocks and the like selling off massively, at least over the past 4 days. Today we had a little bit of a comeback in those names, but it's causing a huge rotation, and it's really shifting market dynamics in a big way. And I want to talk about them for the next half hour or so.
Yeah, come back in those stocks, but still off for the week as we film here a little after 3 p.m. on Friday. You know, Ed, this reminds me of a conversation that you and I had several times over the last year, which is one of duration on these bonds, and also about low base effects and percentage change.
Yeah, I've been saying for a long time that move that's happening now would happen. You know, I wrote something in Credit Write Downs back in August about momentum stocks being a version of a long duration play, and that obviously if we had a tick up in yields, exactly what we're seeing would happen. What I find the most interesting, actually, there are two things I find interesting. One is that we have this rotation effect that Jack was talking about. So you rotate it from growth to value, or value to growth, based upon what's happening. The yields have gone up so much that we've had a massive rotation. And then as yields backed off a little bit, we've seen a rotation back. To me, that sounds like that we have algorithmic trading that is doing something based upon where the yields are. Second thing that I would note in terms of yields is a great chart that Ola Hansen from Saxo Bank put up. It's gold versus the U.S. 10-year real yield. And a lot of people, you know, they always talk about gold. What does gold do? How does it trade? Basically, this chart is telling you that for the last year and a half, last 2 years, it's been a real yield play. That gold is really about real yields. That is that gold, it doesn't yield anything. And so you're giving up yield by holding gold. And so when you have monetary repression, what happens with negative real yields is gold is more attractive. This chart here, it shows gold and the U.S. 10-year real yield in lockstep. That means that when the real yield goes down, gold goes up. And recently, between, I would say, October and this recent rally, there's been a divergence there. That is that the real yield has stayed relatively low and gold is sold off. That has all caught up in a hurry. We're now back on track where gold and the real yield are tracking together. So I think that that's another story behind what's happening in terms of the rates.
Yeah. And of course, worth pointing out, this is true of real yields, but not nominal yields. Nominal yields can spike dramatically and gold can rise as a consequence.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, if you look at this chart, the red part of the chart is the one that is real yield part, the 10-year real yield. And you can see that real yields are going up massively with this spike. The question is what kind of base effects are we going to get with regard to inflation? Because we know that with the lockdowns a year or so ago, it's going to have some impact. I suspect that real yields will continue to be relatively good. And so that will put pressure on gold for some time to come. We'll see what happens once we get the base effects of, the post March, April timeframe.
Yeah. Jack, thoughts?
I can't see the chart that Ed's talking about, but I can sort of see it in my head. And the relationship between gold and real rates is, I think, one of the most pivotal in finance. I've got another one on my screen, which is the monthly change in gold. So this month, February, gold has actually had the worst month since late 2016. So, in the same way that these rising yields have been kryptonite for tech, because they, it's caused a massive sell-off in gold as well.
Yeah, and with tech, it's important to point out some of the mechanics of why this is happening. So when you have very low rates, you're able to discount cash flows on growth stocks in a much more favorable way. And when those rates begin to rise, it begins to put pressure on growth stocks. And you see this rotation into cyclical stocks, which is something that we see. It happens. It bounces back and forth. There's this kind of flirtation in both directions. And it's interesting to see where that is going to land ultimately. And it seems to be, to your point, Ed, and to your point, Jack, ultimately very dependent upon rates, because that's where the sensitivity is.
Yeah. And so when Jack was pointing out the rapidity with which rates went up, I think that that's the interesting part of it. Even though you had a rotation, you also had a sell-off at the same time. You don't necessarily have to have a sell-off. You could have a rotation into certain stylistic factors, a growth over value or value over growth without any sort of impact overall. But what we saw is that rates went up so aggressively that we saw a sell-off, and it was more of a sell-off for the growthiest names because those are the ones, as you were saying, Ash, are the most vulnerable given the discount rates.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a quick back of the envelope way of thinking about rising rates, typically it's one of two cases. Either you see real growth expectations rising or you see inflation rising. It's a really interesting time because we seem to have some commodity price inflation right now and also expectation of what's going to happen to growth when the economy reopens. Obviously, we're getting some very positive data with COVID right now. The disease seems to be under control. It seems to be moving under control, might be a better way to say it. Obviously, there are still far too many people getting ill. But the expectation is that as we see the cases decline, as we see the number of people who are getting the vaccine rise, that we're going to have a reopening of the economy. So, Ed, how do you think about that? How do you balance out those two different definitions or those two different ways of getting rising rates?
I'm thinking about nominal GDP growth and nominal yields going up in lockstep. So as nominal GDP growth increases, then you should see a concomitant increase in nominal yields. The real question is the real versus the inflation part of it.
Right.
And that's where the impact on stocks and on other asset classes comes into play, because you can get a lot of that juice via inflation, or you can get a lot of it via real GDP growth, i.e. real growth. The jury's still out for me. I'm not a big inflation guy. I do think that the risk of inflation is as high as it's been. And given some of the numbers that we've seen for Q1, and we also had this stimulus of $1.9 trillion. That's definitely going to happen. I believe it was today that they said that they were going to end up passing it. That's going to be giving people stimulus checks. We saw that real income went up like 10% in the last month. So you have a lot of money sloshing about. That definitely gives you the possibility of having at least a step change in price levels. That's not inflation. It's just a step change in price levels. So for me, the jury's still out as to whether it's real GDP growth or whether it is inflation.
Yeah, it's really such a complicated thing, especially when you see the very sharp decrease that we did around COVID, because you have this sliding window. So you have the old data falling out, which shows the great drops, and the rises may be something more akin to coming back to a baseline of growth from where we were. So there are a lot of variables that that exist here, and it's definitely a complicated time to sort through this.
You know, I don't want to get in front of Jack here because he has some things that he wants to talk about in the credit markets as well. But there was another chart I saw in terms of credit that was interesting. It was the option adjusted spread, you know, the high yield spread to treasuries. And you could see, if you look at that chart, it's just showing the part that is in the recession during the lockdown period and beyond. And you can see that it's going way up, the spread, and then it came down. And we're now at a level where we were before the crisis began. And interestingly, if you look, there's really no impact whatsoever from the tick up in real yields and also the tick up in nominal yields on the spread. So even though yields are going up, spreads in high yield aren't going up. So what it's telling you is that there's no distress, there's no liquidity problems that have seeped into high yield as a result of the uptick in yields that we've seen. So overall, what that it says is that's bullish. It's bullish for risk assets. It's telling you that the sky is blue, and you know you can continue to go forward.
I guess cynic might point out that, look, you know, the Fed balance sheet expands to $7.5 trillion. You've got fiscal stimulus coming out of Congress, as you point out, voting today in the House on $1.9 trillion in additional stimulus. And then, of course, more specifically to the high yield situation, we have the so-called 13-3 programs out of the New York Fed that are providing liquidity for those markets. So, again, one of the paradoxes that comes up, again, kind of the real or nominal, is this stimulus or is it demand?
Yeah, it doesn't really make a difference, does it? Jack, you were going to say something, weren't you?
Yeah. That's the more cynical answer to a cynical question I've ever heard, Ed. Does it matter?
Yeah, so Ed, I'm curious. You mentioned that high yield spreads didn't budge that much, but that's the spread relative to the Treasury, not the actual yield itself. So if that's true, that would mean that actual yields did rise alongside Treasuries. Would that be right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. They did rise. And, you know, my expectation would be that eventually there's enough pain as a result of a rise in Treasuries that not only would the rates themselves rise in lockstep, that the spreads would rise as well. But we haven't seen that. And it suggests to me that we still have abundant amounts of liquidity in that market.
We get to break out the great Latin phrase, pari passu.
Absolutely. So, Ed, you talked about high yield. I think of high yield as typically having a maturity that's shorter than investment grade, because I'm looking at the yields of the investment grade 10-year treasury plus the average investment grade bond spread, and it's absolutely getting slammed, going from about 1% in January to now just under 2.3%. And you're seeing this cause ripples all across the fixed income spectrum. For example, and this is something, Ed, I know you've talked with David Rosenberg, how, you know, back in the old days of, let's say, 2 years ago, when yields were so low, people who they couldn't invest in high yield, what they did, they invested in extremely long duration bonds. So, you know, an Apple bond that's due in 2061, a CVS bond that's due in 2050. Well, all those bonds, or the type of those bonds, those are in LQD, which is the ETF for liquid investment grade debt. And that's down almost 7% just this year. Meanwhile, Treasuries, TLT is down a similar number this year. And by the way, I think I read the short interest on LQD went from about 6% to now over 20%. So people are no longer just short bonds. They're shorting shorting treasury bonds. They're now shorting LQD as well. So what I want to know is, yeah, what's going to happen to the high yield market and what's going to happen to the leveraged loan market where the duration is typically shorter? So it's thought to be a protection against that interest rate risk. What I'm seeing now is that the market's saying credit risk doesn't really matter. What we are afraid of is interest rate risk.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything that says that credit risk matters yet. I don't see these spreads as being indicative of people having problems with the credit situation. There's abundant liquidity. And so for me, since credit leads the cycle, it would suggest that we still have upside. We could consolidate and then move higher as a result. And ultimately, when you have so much money in the pipeline from stimulus, going back to Ash's original question, it's very hard to think that you're going to get a durable sell-off either in credit or in equities because the market is raging ahead. We're talking 7% real GDP growth potentially for the entirety of 2021. I mean, we haven't seen numbers like that in at least 40 years.
Yeah, and that looks probably like a rebound effect from some of this. The declines we saw is a consequence of COVID. So obviously we see right now, we were talking a little earlier about commodity price inflation, CRB index up, lumber, copper rising very rapidly. But let me throw out an alternate view from someone whose opinion matters a little bit more than yours and mine and everyone on this call. Jay Powell saying we're a long way from our employment goals and we're a long way from our inflation goals. We are still not able to attain 2%.
I think that Fed Chair Powell is correct in that just because, crude oil was up 18% over the past month, copper up 15%, lumber up a ton. That doesn't mean that is true inflation. It can be supply chain constraints. We saw that in Texas, where those shutdowns shut down 40% of the production of crude oil. So, if you're looking at the production, that doesn't mean that it's inflation. And then on the jobs market, which Ed knows a lot more about that than I do, but typically when you have so many people unemployed, that's not a sign that inflation is going to pick up anytime soon.
Yeah. I see what you did there with that ton of lumber pun, Jack.
Accidental, I assure you.
to talk about jobs, it's interesting. I've been spending more time focusing on the digital assets, crypto markets, and I'm probably less read into the daily news cycle on capital markets. But interestingly, it's given me kind of a different perspective because I'm not following the day-to-day gyrations. I'm thinking a little bit more big picture. And for me, if you want a single chart that talks about where the real economy is right now, it's this chart on jobs. And when you look at this chart, what you see is what we've been talking about here on Real Vision Daily Briefing for over a year now, the inverse radical recovery. You see that number steadily rising from left to right, and then you see the very steep drop, and you see a sharp V-shaped recovery, but a V-shaped recovery that doesn't get you up to where you were at the time the crisis started. Now, the important point to think about, when you look at that chart, you'd have to extrapolate that slope from where we were on the left to figure out where we should be at a natural grade of growth that's been in place for a decade now. We are still far, far below that. That means that real people in the real economy are suffering as asset prices rise.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly, I was thinking about that from the perspective of GDP. I haven't looked at the numbers, but if we get a 7% real GDP growth level, that would suggest that by the end of 2021, we'll be at the same level or higher than we were when we went into the COVID crisis. So what it says is that there's more GDP, more economy at the end of 2021 than there was in March of 2020. And if you have this reverse radical not getting you back to where you were on a jobs perspective, that's implicitly telling you that it's a winner-take-all type of economy. You know, the K-shaped recovery, where some people are not benefiting and other people are benefiting to excess. And they're the ones who are creating the extra GDP and reaping the benefits of that.
That's exactly right. And that's the nightmare scenario. GDP, of course, C plus G plus I plus NX. And if that the labor share of that is decreasing, what you could see is a dramatic shift basically from labor to capital. And that is a very bad thing for at least two reasons. One, because it means that real people, real wage earners can suffer dramatically, which is probably the most important point. But the second is there's this difference between marginal propensity to save and marginal propensity to consume. The higher the income individuals earn, the more likely they are to invest or save that money. And the less they earn, the more likely they are to go back into the economy and spend it on goods and services. That has a dramatic increase in demand, which is 66% of the U.S. economy, roughly 2/3. So when you think about this, it could be something that could be very difficult if these trends continue.
Absolutely. Yeah, and when you talk about the investment side, obviously, it all depends on where the investments are. I mean, it's not like people are investing in brick and mortar retail. They're investing in things that are relatively speculative at this point in time. So that's something also to be concerned about.
Yeah, they're also investing in technology. If you think about the NASDAQ, all those technologies are almost by definition labor saving and capital intensive. And that just increases this disparity, the imbalance in the economy.
Jack, you were going to say?
Yes. Well, I was going to say, Ash, about a minute ago, you said two things are true. And I was going to turn it back on you both and say, how does that react? I mean, it was about the marginal propensity to spend. I was going to say, what do you think of the failure to pass or to include in the most recent stimulus bill the $15 minimum wage? Because, you know, if you think of the low minimum wage workers, those are the people who, out of all workers, have the highest propensity to spend. So you put a dollar in their hands, that the most of that dollar is going to reroute itself to the economy, as opposed to, you know, a billionaire who's just going to invested in the treasury bond or something like that. So what did you make of the fact that the $15 minimum wage did not get in the stimulus bill?
It's a great question. So in terms of the economics, there are two schools of thought on this. The first is precisely the point that you made. And the flip side is that if you increase the minimum wage, what you're doing is you're going to price a lot of workers out of the market, and you're actually going to increase unemployment. I think there's some validity to this. It actually follows kind of a curve. The question is one of levels. And if you think about the federal minimum wage today, by the way, states have their own minimum wages that are generally higher. In fact, they must be higher by definition than the federal minimum wage. But the current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. 15, obviously, more than double, 7.25. So the question is, when you make that swing very dramatically, does it have an impact on the lowest wage and most vulnerable workers that actually ends up pricing them out of the market? And might it have deleterious effects? I think that may be some of the thinking behind why it didn't find the support that it needed to pass in Congress.
Yeah, you know, my view, I guess, it's also somewhat nuanced. I'll say this, that I'm probably from Gen X, and we're much more sort of market oriented and look askance at some of these policies, which are much more heavy-handed. People might use the term socialist. I think that that's a generational divide. I think that people who are in the younger generation are sort of fed up with the status quo, and they want to get at a solution no matter how they achieve it. And I'm somewhat skeptical about being able to achieve it with a blunt instrument like a $15 minimum wage. But having said that, you know, studies have not shown that marginal increases in minimum wages or in wage levels actually do put people out of work. The meta studies that they've shown, it does, as you were saying, Ash, depend on how much you're going. So if you are in Arkansas and there's you know, a lot more people who are making closer to minimum wage, and you jack the rate up to $15 an hour, that's going to be a problem. Versus in San Francisco, I think it'll probably be less of a problem. So in that sense, you could create those kinds of externalities. For me, Joel Greenblatt, his solution, I think, was an interesting one, which is the earned minimum tax credit, I believe he said. He basically said, you know, let people get the amount of wage that they can get and have the government make up the difference in some capacity. Don't set the minimum wage on the company. Do it in some capacity so that the wage earner gets the money, but you know, it's not causing excess unemployment.
Yeah, that's extremely well said, Ed, and very nuanced. And you know, I think you're absolutely right. It's totally dependent on level. You know, personally wouldn't want to live in an America where people make 75 cents an hour just because the poor person needs to work for that wage. That would be a terrible thing. Conversely, if you want to come up with the absurd proposition on the opposite side of the equation, we can't just all vote ourselves into being millionaires by having a $1,000 minimum wage. So the question is really, where do these balances fall? And I think that's exactly right. It is an incredibly difficult trade-off and balancing act. And also the regional differences are significant, which makes it very challenging for such a blunt tool to kind of be a panacea that solves all of our problems.
The comment occurred to me that I was going to say that I wonder how much it would cost to make the minimum wage something very high, like $50. You know, how much would that cost per month relative to the $120 billion that the Fed is plowing into treasuries and mortgage-backed securities? But now I'm going to use that sort of, let's dodge that question, and I want to move on. And I want to move back to the central question, which is the rise in interest rates. And I want to share just my thinking about it. I think of interest rates sort of like financial gravity, that when they're so low, these tech stocks can fly very high because they are so focused on growth that their cash flows dated out to 2040, they matter a great deal. And it's about how quickly they can grow. Present isn't so important. But as interest rates rise, simply put, the future isn't worth what it used to be. And then all those high-flying tech stocks, the gravity increases and they get to slow down. So we saw that in Tesla, we saw that in Roku, we saw that in Square, in Teladoc, Spotify, Shopify, all these growth names. And by the way, I might add, those were the top holdings in the ARK Innovation ETF. Yeah. And that ETF is down something like 30% just this week. And I've got a chart of the outflows. People are really fleeing this ETF. And as money flows out of the ETF, they have to sell their underlying holdings in order to meet those redemptions. And that's something that Jared Dillian talked about on Wednesday. He's got a background. He used to work in ETFs. I don't want to sort of paint a doomsday scenario. I don't think the ARK Innovation ETF is going to go bust. But, you know, if decreasing interest rates is good for tech stocks, and that's been what they've been attaching their hook to as they go up, then as interest rates increase, tech stocks have to go down. And I think even looking at implied volatility in these stocks names, like just like Tesla, which is something that I was following pretty closely this week, the implied volatility is much, much higher. So the options are much, much more expensive, even relative to the price decrease. So market participants are pricing in that there could be a lot more volatility, and perhaps to the downside.
Jack, I love that metaphor of financial gravity. So the question to you, Ed, is what happens if we go from living on Mercury to living on Jupiter?
Yeah, I mean, the real question is, it goes back to the beginning of the conversation. Are we just going to consolidate at 150 and go back to a normal world? Or, and this is what J.P. Morgan thinks, by the way, I was reading the J.P. Morgan view. They think that, in terms of the volatility, that the end of easy money will be a regime shift. But in our view, it will be a protracted multi-phase one involving a tapering announcement and a pause before a first hike. And so they think that, you know, we're mostly at the end of this volatility, or rather the uptick in yields. Let's see. That's the $64,000 question. We're at the 150 level or thereabouts right now. Where are we going to be in a month's time? I think that's where the proof is in the pudding.
That sounds like a masterpiece of sell side research. One of those things where the answer is so complicated that you can claim partial victory in just about every scenario.
Yeah, well, Ash, that's what a fund manager does if something goes up, is they sell half of it so that if it goes down, they feel like they were smart for selling it. And if it goes up, they feel smart for still owning it. But Ash, I actually really like your metaphor of going from Venus to Jupiter. And I actually know, because I'm a little bit of a sci-fi nerd. I've read a few books about people living on Mars. And the gravity there is sufficiently light that once you live on Mars for a long time, you really can't go back to Earth because your bones just get too weak and your muscles just get too weak. So the question is, these growth stocks, have they become too weak in this low growth environment?
If there's anything nerdier than talking about finance, it's talking about finance with sci-fi metaphors.
Yeah, definitely.
So as we get near the conclusion here, I'm curious to get your final thoughts. Jack, what are you thinking about as you look forward into next week?
Well, Ash, to just sort of flip it back to you, Bitcoin has been a tremendously lucrative asset to own over the past year. This week, though, I think we had the worst drawdown since March of last year. And specifically, this is, I know, something that you've been following, Ash, because you're in this world, but also Ed has been following, is the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which I full disclosure, I own that, and I also own some Bitcoin on the side. But they traded at a significant premium to net asset value, or NAV, because there were institutional investors, the reasoning went, who wanted to buy Bitcoin, but they couldn't own Bitcoin because their trusts, their bylaws said that they couldn't. So they bought Grayscale, or they bought MicroStrategy, something that they could actually put in their portfolio. So that's why GBTC traded at a premium. But now, if you look, it's actually trading at a 3.7% discount. So that's something that I've got on my radar.
Yeah, and actually, he stole my thunder, Ash. That's what I was going to say, exactly that. And it goes back to you. You, the questioner, become the questioned. How are you thinking about it?
Well, I'll take the first one first, the drawdown. So I'm looking at a chart here, a one-month chart on Bitcoin. So Bitcoin rolls from 32,000 almost 58,000, and then it comes down to 47,000. You go, oh, no, the drawdown has been terrible. I mean, yes, as a mathematical proposition, the drawdown for that time period, that window, has been relatively high. But look, it's been on an absolute tear. I think, to me, and I've said this before, the day-to-day gyrations in the price of Bitcoin are the least interesting aspect of the crypto market. Now, obviously, we cover it because lots of people are investing and trading in a relatively short time horizon. But to me, that's not the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. In terms of the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, I should probably say I own a very small position of GBTC myself. Not that I'm going to move the price by talking about it, but it is something that I own in a very small quantity. Look, you know, that product was, I think, perhaps something that was very much of a specific era. The closed-end fund, when institutions wanted to get in, they wanted to get exposure. They weren't yet comfortable on the custody side with the asset itself, and they were looking for a mechanism to do it. Obviously, as you point out, Jack, correctly, the variability between the net asset value and the current market price often traded at a very large premium. Now we're seeing that unwind. We're seeing the reverse. We're seeing it trade as a discount. It seems to me to be something that was very much a product of its time. There are two major changes that are happening right now. Number one, global custody solutions for retail investors and institutional investors have increased dramatically. Next Tuesday, I have Anthony Scaramucci on the podcast, Ground Floor Consensus. He talks about the fund that he spun up, and he talks about what he needed to come into this space. He's very much an institutionalist. He was a bit skeptical of investing client funds in it early on in the game. And what made him comfortable was Fidelity. That's his custodian on it, because one, they have a massive balance sheet, and two, they have insurance from Lloyd's of London to protect against potential loss. So that's one side of the equation. The other side is ETFs. Now, we don't currently have a U.S. regulated ETF, but we've got one in Canada. Regulators down under in Australia are talking about allowing ETFs for Bitcoin. It seems like it's a matter of time before an ETF is available for U.S. Retail investors that can be easily accumulated. It seems to me that that's going to be the direction that we're going in. And I think that perhaps some of the closed-end fund products may get a lower market capitalization as a consequence. This, you know, very much a natural progression, in my view, of the development of the market.
Absolutely.
So you're not at all concerned that Grayscale has the net asset value is below the value of Bitcoin that they hold before these things have come to fruition. There are no ETFs in the U.S., and this is already happening.
Well, my position is small enough that it's not going to have an impact on my life. And I think that Digital Currency Group is going to do fine no matter what. I just think it's a natural balancing act. I expect it'll probably come back on a percentage basis between net asset value and the current price. But it's not something that I'm especially concerned about. I don't think it impacts the space, most importantly, right? Like, I don't think that that this slight skew is going to change any of the fundamental dynamics. It's very clear, if you look at this, in my view at least, over a long time horizon, if you look at it today and where we find ourselves in 2031, the direction for adoption of digital assets is just going to continue to increase.
Yeah, Ash, you know, so you are a veteran in the crypto space, and you really know a lot of that about it. So because of that, you aren't really excited about the price action. You're much more interested in the technology. But I, you know, I am a novice in the space. I'm a tyro. So it actually, the price action actually is sort of my way, my entry point into crypto. And I might add about the net asset values. There's also a Grayscale Ethereum Trust, which I think last summer was trading about 600% of a premium to net asset value. So this really is a very interesting moment. Ash, I'm very much looking forward to your interview on Ground Floor Consensus with Anthony Scaramucci. As we close, since you plugged, I might say that there's a great masterclass with Brent Johnson today on the Plus tier, interviewed by Jason Buck. And then it doesn't end there. On next Monday, or you know, on Monday, Raoul is going to be speaking to Jim Rogers, who shares his outlook on what we've been talking about: rising rates, inflation, commodities. He also shares his outlook on his memories of 1987, Black Monday, where Dow Jones crashed a tremendous amount. Jim tells Raoul that he was actually short the market, and that Black Monday occurred on his birthday, so that he got quite a birthday present.
So you've seen the interview already, so you know what they talked about.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, great.
Hey, Jack, let me just say, if the price action on Bitcoin isn't sufficient for you, I'm looking right now at February 27, 2020, price $8,800. Current trade, last trade, about 47,000.
That's a good point, Ash. That is, they still are have made a lot of money. What is that, like 6x?
Something like that. Not bad. Ed, Jack, thanks for joining us.
Have a great weekend, everyone.